Creoso, and welcome back to the Welsh History Podcast, episode 213, Hester Lynch Salisbury, part 2, Sufficient to be Successful. Last episode, we talked a lot about the early life of Hester, sometimes called Hetty, by the way, so if I end up using Hetty at some point, you'll understand that it's kind of a nickname that both her and her daughter and her mother, because they were all Hesters, used at some points. And we're going to talk a little bit about how her influence of her education and her love of poetry and storytelling was now creating the person she was. At age 22, she would be married to Henry Thrail, who she did not have a great deal of interest before or seemingly after marriage. While you can't completely call it a loveless marriage, it was certainly one of convenience. It saved the Salisburys from a point in time where they would have financially struggled. Certainly, you have to imagine that had it not been for this marriage, that Hester and her mother probably would have been in a great deal of trouble and probably have to move back home with some sort of relatives, simply because without the male presence in the house, it was a lot more difficult for women at this point to earn money. So it was a marriage that created stability for the women. Seemingly, what kept them together was the love both had for her mother. Henry had lost his mother at a young age, and so having this woman in his life allowed him to continue to have this matronly representation. It, of course, allowed him to marry the woman he desired and gain some of the reputation and some of the position that he craved, while also including this figure who he got along with so well. Hester described this early period of her marriage in this way, in quote, "We lived on terms of great civility and politeness, if not strong alliance and connection," end quote. They basically got along more or less as friends rather than as a married couple, and neither seemed, at least in Hester's writing, to care for the other greatly, at least in the beginning. Thrail, it seemed, was not interested in sharing Hester, however, with many others, as he tried to stop any local relationships that he perceived to be too close. He was, in effect, dominating her in a way very similar to the way her father had, bringing another male figure in her life, creating this issue, something she obviously would never appreciate. This, of course, was something she bucked against and tried via small measures to at least deter some of the worst habits of her new husband. Anyone who's been in a relationship with someone who's verbally or physically abusive, you know that you learn how to limit your exposure to that person and being on the wrong side of their anger and attitude. Don't confront, don't make waves, become a watchword that you experience daily, and you feel better about yourself when you're by yourself. If anything, reading about Hester's life has taught me, it's that she definitely understood the value of avoiding trouble. In 1764, she became pregnant with her first child, and her daughter Hester Maria was born September 17th. Hester would have a total of 12 pregnancies and 4 children would actually live to adulthood. We're going to talk about this in further depth as we go through this episode, but something you should know in advance. Through it all, she seemed to endure almost out of spite against the dominance of her family during that time period. Hester would eventually be introduced to Arthur Murphy, an Irish playwright, poet, actor, and wildly barrister. He was a friend of the Thrails who actually paid attention to Hester and struck up a friendship with her. It would be in a significant one and one of the few that would allow her to stretch herself. It was through a relationship that she was to be introduced to one of the major influences that would come into her life, Samuel Johnson. Johnson, who at this point was 55 on first introduction, seemed to be immediately captured by the attention and the attraction of the young lady, and apparently, unlike so many other people, he would be the person that Henry, instead of trying to keep away, would actually encourage to come closer to their family discussions and conversations. This, I think, was in part because Henry did not necessarily understand the lifeline he had given to his wife. Or if he did, he never made it clear to her because she seemingly didn't understand, or at least in her own writings, seemed to think that it was against him rather than with him. The biggest thing that seemed to come from this was the early poetry and literature that Hester had been craving, the education that she had received from both uncles and tutors growing up, was now going to continue, and it was going to grow. It was something she had struggled to achieve, and under which she saw so much of the dominion and control that others had had over her melt away. Hester found in Johnson someone who could match her wit and was willing to engage in combative discussions for which she had craved so greatly. She was pleased that he took her thoughts and writing seriously enough, not just to act as critic or hype man, but also would be willing to work with her on her translations and poems as a partner rather than just an overseer or senior advisor. Johnson was so taken by her that he would be willing to stay with them, which, of course, seems a bit odd to our mindset, but Hester's entire life seemed to be fairly odd at this stage. So if we've noted anything so far, is that her acquaintanceships with older men was not something she was unfamiliar with. It was actually how she received a great deal of her education, and she seemed to appreciate him for his intelligence. Of course, Johnson, as I've said in the past episode, was the man who developed the first English language dictionary and was a key cog in the London literary societies of the mid to late 1700s. And for himself, Johnson definitely felt a connection as well, and he himself said, in quote, "Where should be pleasure be sought, but under Mrs. Thrale's influence," end quote. To be honest, it feels odd, a 55-plus-year-old man, to be so reliant and seemingly smitten by a young woman who is married and having children and pregnancies throughout this period. And make no mistake, at initial blush, it does look quite peculiar, especially with Johnson's tendency to surround himself with young women who may or may not have been people he was pursuing romantically. In the case of Hester, though, it almost comes across over time as you read more and more about their relationship of a fatherly figure, someone who could represent something that Hester really didn't have, which was a father who matched her intellectual wit and had no representation of the violent side of things. In fact, quite honestly, Hester would state or at least measure Johnson based on the fact that she thought he was a moral and upstanding character. So if that's the case, that kind of points away from being a romantic ensuing and looking out for her in that way. In fact, it definitely seemed more and more as time went on that he was that father figure she needed and definitely seemed to be focused that way. Hester's eldest daughter became another prodigy child and one who captured Johnson as well, so much so he called her Queen Hetty or Queenie, a nickname which seemed to have stuck. He suddenly became this grandfatherly figure in the house with this precocious child upon which he would often dote. She also became frustrated with the men in that age in the later 18th century who were uninterested with intelligent women, as she herself explained to one musician. Quote, "Dr. Burnley did not like that his daughter should learn Latin, even of Johnson, who offered to teach her for friendship, because she would have been as wise as himself, forsooth, and Latin was too masculine for Mrs. A narrow-souled goose gap the man must be at last," end quote. While the sentiment is pretty obvious, the language itself would certainly not fit in our current day. The frustration that she's expressing here certainly is something that would not be unfamiliar for women for many, many years to come. Yet in all the New Age thinking Hester had, she was not a radical. She supported Henry's run for MP in the area of London that they lived in. She made fun of those who sought to bring radical reforms to Britain. She was anti the Revolutionary War and fought against, at least verbally, the opinions that were expressed there. And she appeared to be willing and able to mock them on all of these important things that seemed to be so important to a modern person. She may have had what we would be considered feminist leanings, yet she was still a product of her age and influenced by the people that she had surrounded herself with, most of whom had no tolerance for the democratic liberty movements, which would explode in America and France in the next couple of decades. All this time, while the family was growing up and the life of Henry and his business as a brewer continued to grow in progress, it also meant that Henry Thrale was always looking for ways to make his business better, sometimes in ways that were not going to make his business better. And it was one of these times when he took a terrible business risk, trying to get ahead of brewing competitors in a way which would be similar to a disaster. Especially if you grew up in the 80s, it would definitely not be unfamiliar, such as something like New Coke. If you have no idea what I'm referring to, please look it up, because it's an interesting study in corporate speak that kind of deluded themselves into thinking that they needed to change for the sake of change. And Thrale's decided to change the way his brew of beer was made, and in doing so, it actually created undrinkable beer and lost him a fortune. And because of it, it destroyed not just the company, but also the wages that they were going to be paying the employees. And on the verge of this financial chaos, Hester stepped in and took charge, begging friends for help, traveling to their houses for loans and largesses that allowed the business and the family to survive the terrible moves of Henry and allowed them the space to recover, as they, of course, were dependent upon that income to survive. Her willingness from 1772, when all this began, to get involved in the running of the accounts of the business and to stare down those who sought to gain advantage from their weakness showed that she was never going to accept failure, even as her husband despaired and previously Johnson doubted her acumen on these things outside of academia. She was, at the end of the day, a hard-headed person who was not going to just bend over and suffer the problems and financial distresses that she had experienced as a young woman. As Henry regained his momentum and arrived from his depression to fire back and work again, he reattempted similar failed experiments. In this instance, specifically in 1773, it was when her mother passed away, cutting the last real link she had with her family in Wales and the borderlands. And it was a time of sadness, but for Hester, unwilling to simply give in when their livelihood was in jeopardy, she instead worked through all of her sadness and grief, trying to deal with a very young family, as well as dealing with the business problems that her husband continued to create. Finally, in 1774, as the storm in the colonies was about to erupt, in order to deal with her mother's estate, she joined Johnson, Henry, and their eldest child, Hester, or Hetty, as she's been known, or Queenie, in North Wales. It was the first time that the family had been able to step away from all of their problems, and because of this, Hester had a lot of anxiety because some of her younger children, which there were some at this point, were left in London to be cared for while she went to North Wales, and this created some conflict of feelings in herself. However, she wanted to go back to Wales, and it was important to her, and they toured from the very northeast to the very northwest, from the edges of the borderlands all the way to the edge of the Irish Sea. And while she seemingly enjoyed herself, the trip was viewed much more caustically by Johnson specifically, who seemed to be very much unimpressed both with the northeast Welsh landscape and the various sites, with the possible exception of some of the old Edwardian castles that he witnessed, which in a way made Hester feel sad because both her husband and her fatherly figure were both being very rude about the country that she grew up in and loved. And in fact, when she described her experience at the castle at Denby, she said that she saw it, in quotes, "wild in its situation, rude in its appearance, the haunt of screaming gulls and clamorous rooks," end quote. In other words, she had a romantic idea about what this place looked like and felt like, and it's something that obviously she felt dear about. In fact, she would go a long way in trying to teach these two Englishmen about Wales and about what it was to her, a place of mystery and charm to go along with the familiar haunts of her early youth. She had loved Wales and fought against these companions of hers about it. She may have been away from the place for over a decade, but there was no escaping the respect and love she had for it. If you're like me and eating healthy is a bit of a problem, let me bend your ear a little bit to eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggies. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. Also, if you're looking for gourmet meals, try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/WelshHistoryPod50 and use the code WelshHistoryPod50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code WelshHistoryPod50 at factormeals.com/WelshHistoryPod50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Now, you might be asking, dear listener, are we talking and taking so much time discussing the early life of someone who was born in Wales, but did not spend much of her life here. Why have we spent so much time specifically talking about the more mundane and daily experiences, friendships, and all of that? Well, in part, because Hester represents the type of person we hardly hear about. As I mentioned last episode, women are almost totally lost to us in time because they rarely have their own voice. They're rarely able to talk about themselves. Typically, they're rarely even represented in the histories and novels of things that we have. If anything, they're little more than a device. So it's a lot more difficult to gain an idea about who they were and what they were concerned about and the things that they wanted out of life. The idea that they might have had their own totally acceptable ambitions, dreams, and nuanced viewpoints is something we just don't see in history to this point. It is obviously something worthy of capturing, keeping in mind that even amongst the elites, it was not up until this period normal to read, let alone write. Outside of certain professions specifically, you almost didn't need it. But this is when that started to change, and so as I said, it meant that we started to hear voices that up to this point were fairly silent. And obviously, currently we're talking about the 18th century. As we get into the 19th century, this becomes more and more common. And not only do we get different voices, we get different writers who are talking about things both mundane and important, if you want to call them such. And all of those things become much more well covered and much more significant. But this is really our first real window into that, because Hester was a journal keeper, because she kept journals of various types, both in her poetry and writings, but also a daily log of her family and the activities they did. Something, again, you just don't get a lot of to this point. And so it's incredibly significant. And so why am I spending so much time explaining this, you might ask? Well, we spend a lot of time with Owen Glyndwr, Henry Tudor, and men of power. So it is, to my mind, something that makes sense to actually cover the life of someone who is more representative of the normal. Hester and her 12 children, four of which survived into childhood, are not a bug. They are a feature of living in 18th century society. Many, many women had many, many children, many of whom died at childbirth and at young ages. Motherhood was a stressful and sometimes horrible period. Trying to have children was difficult. Medicine was not well planned out, thought of, or scientifically sound at times. Cures in some of this era were things like hot wine for flu, as an example. As you can imagine, most of these things were at best placebos. Where real diseases were running rampant, they had little solutions outside of what they hoped were cures. And the damage and loss of so many children would definitely play on the minds of any parent, no matter how much you stole yourself against it, no matter how often you prepared for that difficulty. Spending your 20s and your 30s in and out of pregnancy as well must have made the physical well-being of Hester very difficult, and many other women of this era. Your life was not your own, and of course, this was part of the reason why so many would die in childbirth. And Hester had the additional issue that not only was she dealing with all of this stuff, she also had to keep working for her husband, helping him in his workplace, but also helping him in political campaigning, creating speeches, and ensuring the success of the family while doing all of that, and carrying and delivering children. And yet somehow still have the intellectual ability through all this to continue to write her own poetry, create translations of other people's writings, as well as writing her own stories and letters, which were then published in other eras and issues of different magazines. This was a woman aggressively willing to do what had to be done while fighting the prejudice of her era the whole time. Yet, through all of this, Hester did not lose her sense of wit and wisdom. In describing her own portrait, she cheekily said, in a very poetic fashion, "In features so placid, so smooth, so serene, what trace of wit or the Welshwoman seen? Of the temper sarcastic and flattering tongue, the sentiment right or the occasion still wrong? What trace of the tender, the rough, the refined, the soul in which all of the contraries joined? Where, though merriment, love over method to rule, religion reside and virtues keep school? Till when, tired we, condemn her dogmatical air, like a rocket she rises and leaves us to stare." The magnificence of a portrait was not her. It was, at best, a false image of who and what she was, which many of us can understand all too well when we look at photos and pictures of ourselves even today. It is quite often that we question who it is we look at back at when we see ourselves, even sometimes in the mirror. As Johnson became a feature of the Thrales residence, it also saw more and more of the literati continue to join him. Actors, writers, and those who wanted to rub elbows with the rich and famous of the late 18th century found themselves coming to Hester's house. One was the widow Elizabeth Montagu, a woman who was a member of higher society but also represented the beginnings of change in the power dynamic, as she hosted parties where men and women would speak as equals. A comment which seems weird to us, but obviously was something that had not been the norm in this era, so this was almost seemed, if not scandalous, certainly peculiar. Hester and Elizabeth would become firm friends, so much so that Hester would name Elizabeth godmother of her last born child. In 1780, Henry suffered a stroke, one of a series that he would have, which caused him to deteriorate both mentally and physically. This left Hester effectively in charge of keeping their business running while the war in America was hurting it. Henry's illness continued to grow until the 4th of April, 1781, when he passed away due to a series of what was called apoplectic fits. With the help of Elizabeth and Johnson, Hester was able to revive enough of herself to continue the brewery, which she had devoted so much of her time over the last decade, and to keep it alive and keep it functioning. From a poor gentry girl, at the whim of her powerful uncles, Hester Lynch Salisbury Thrales was now powerful and wealthy businesswoman at the heart of London's literary power. But all through that, it was obvious that she didn't really want to control a business, didn't want to be in charge of the brewery, and one of her happiest days was when she finally sold the business for £135,000, some of which would then be invested, some of which would then pay off the loans and debts of various banks and moneylenders, as well as a large sum went to the manager of her brewery, who had stood by her during the rough times of the near financial insolvency, which had almost overcome the Thrales during Henry's failed schemes a decade earlier. Still, she had a tidy amount, but even then, there were still debts from the past which kept coming due, and slowly, the annual income was whittled down and only amounted to the previously agreed-upon inheritance of £1,000 per year. While, of course, this is no laughable sum in this era, it was certainly not the measure of a London socialite, and Hester's desire to hold on to Welsh lands that her ancestors had owned was part of the cost of her fancier possessions in the capital. So, as we finish this section of her life, the next episode, of course, will focus much more on the later life and writing for which she is most undoubtedly best remembered. But it is always important to remember just how much the trials and tribulations Hester had to fight through to get here and how much it would still cost her in the end. With that, I'd like to thank everyone for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can always reach me at thewelshhistorypodcast@gmail.com. Or you can come talk to me at the place formerly known as Twitter, at Welsh History Pod, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Welsh History Podcast. As well, if you are so inclined, and I so much appreciate, you can always help by joining Patreon, and any amount goes towards all the research I'm doing. I will say the writings and the research that's come out of this has come specifically from a couple of books, mostly because they actually covered her life in a way that was much more thorough and much more well-researched than a casual browse around the internet will ever give you. So thank you all for that. Much appreciated, and I hope you all have a great day. I will let you know right now that the next release for this podcast will be a outside-the-box episode, not actually this particular follow-up. We'll be doing something outside of our normal episode numbering, and I hope you enjoy it. But until then, we'll talk to you later. Take care, have a great day, and see you next time. Bye. Welsh History Podcast is a member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To find more information on them, you can do so at evergreenpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.
Hello everyone, my name is Tom Kearns and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.